This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. As we talked about last week on the show, ticks are the primary disease-causing vector species in the United States. Many species of ticks are thriving in our region, and they pass along a variety of pathogens to humans and animals every year.
They transmit a number of different bacteria, protozoa, which are just microscopic parasites, and viruses to humans that can cause disease. There's also a condition that's related to tick bites called alpha-gal syndrome, which can cause a sensitivity to red meat and other animal products. And so some of these pathogens can really cause serious impacts on people, and not all of those conditions even have treatment.
That was WashU senior scientist Solny Adelstensen. Zoonotic disease, otherwise known as disease transmitted from animals to humans, is a growing health concern, and it's a subject matter our next guest has dedicated her career to. As director of the St. Louis Zoo Institute for Conservation Medicine, wildlife veterinarian and epidemiologist Dr. Sharon Deem wants people to understand just how much human health is dependent on the health of other animals and the environment. Our senior producer, Emily Woodbury, spoke with Dr. Deem last week, and today we'd like to bring you their conversation.
Dr. Deem, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks so much, Emily.
So the last time we had you on the show was January 2020. This was a little over a month from when the WHO declared COVID-19 a pandemic. And you talked about the wet markets where live and dead animals of many different species are mixed together and bought by humans. Here's what you said at the time.
And we know that then viruses can mix and mutate and change, and so these diseases may spill out into the human population. So it isn't like wildlife are sitting around thinking, what disease am I going to give to humankind today? It's more we have changed the way and the relationships that we have with wildlife and other species. And then things such as this coronavirus, which should be on all our minds, may spill into our species or our population.
Coronavirus should be on all of our minds. That was quite a prescient message. Do you think that 5 years later, we've learned the lessons we needed to from COVID-19 about just how much human health is dependent on the health of other animals?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think it's so layered to think about. And we can all sit here five years and 2 months later from that interview and just think about where we as a species have been during those 5 years and the millions of humans that have been lost, the economic costs, the societal changes that COVID-19 brought to the human species. And sure, we've learned a lot of lessons, I think. And some of those are really positive. And we handled the pandemic the best we could, maybe, at that time. And so some of those lessons, I think, are so important for today when we think of some of the public health challenges we face. Some of those lessons might be that we didn't do quite what we might need to do. And so now we need to be looking at how to be prepared and prevent, hopefully, another COVID-19 type pandemic.
And that discussion of wet markets of and I believe we talked to you back then about, or is it called zoonotic diseases? Or
yeah, so zoonotic diseases.
So those
are those diseases that are shared between human and non-human animals. We're all animals, but it's those diseases that the animals share with the human species.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this, when we, again, think of like wet markets, or we think of tropical regions where there's a lot of biodiversity, but zoonotic disease is not something that's just occurring somewhere else in the world, right? It is happening right here, just like we talked on our show last week about tick-borne illness.
Correct.
These are things happening in our region.
Yeah, and the interview you all did last week was amazing, thinking about right here at home in Missouri and how important tick-borne diseases are for humans, our domestic animals, livestock, and wildlife. And so, yeah, tick-borne diseases are definitely one of those shared diseases that can impact across from humans to all other animal species.
Well, today, it's avian influenza that is making headlines. We're seeing a broad range of species that are affected by bird flu. You know, poultry farms are killing off their flocks. It's spreading among dairy cow. Large amounts of dead wild waterfowl are being, you know, washing up on lake shores, rivers, streams. And, you know, we're seeing thousands of seals, actually tens of thousands of seals around the world are dying from the virus. And then other mammals, you know, bears, foxes, domestic cats and dogs, tigers and leopards. To me, as a layperson, mm-hmm. this seems like an extraordinary spread of a virus among many different animal species. Is this iteration of bird flu really remarkable in its ability to cross over between species?
So the short answer, I would say, is yes on one level. I think really when we think of avian influenzas and avian influenza and remind ourselves that back in the early 1900s, that was the last big bad pandemic before COVID where 50 million humans died from that particular strain of avian influenza. And avian influenzas have been around for centuries. And we know that they are naturally and low pathogenic or low just circulating in waterfowl without causing problems. And what's become increasingly occurring over the past few decades is the ability to turn into these high pathogenic avian influenzas. And when we think about high pathogenic, we're considering it for the domestic poultry, right? Is it highly pathogenic for those poultry animals that supply humans with a food source? And the unique thing about this outbreak is that we know that it's spilled over into so many different, not just bird species, but so many different mammal species, as you pointed out, from marine mammals along shorelines to dairy cattle that are part of our food source. So it is of particular concern that this strain has been able to infect so many different species in both birds and mammals. And so I think that, again, to rephrase something I said 5 years ago, is it should be on all our minds right now.
Do we have any clues as to what is behind this?
So I come out thinking about these diseases that are impacting human public health as well as wildlife conservation by thinking about some of the changes that humans have placed on the planet in this time of the Anthropocene. So anthro are humans, right? And we're creating some of our biggest health challenges. And when we think about avian influenza, which I think is such a good example to think about this, and our development of once wetlands, so like our paving over and changing wetlands where these millions of wild birds use as flyover zones, right? Here in the Midwest, we have a flyover zone for wildlife birds. And in many of these places where we've modified the habitats, we've also created large poultry factories or poultry farms, right? So the ability for wild birds to mix with domestic birds and share these viruses makes a virus happy in many ways, helps with mutations that can occur that changes a once lowly pathogenic, happy little virus into a highly pathogenic one. So I think when we consider these zoonotic pathogens that are impacting the human population today, we need to think about how we are creating the landscape that allows for these shared pathogens to then be spill over into the human population.
That's so interesting because it seems like, you know, our wild spaces are so disconnected from, you know, our cities or suburbs, and even the rural areas where there's a lot of these concentrated animal feeding operations. And it, you know, even in those, the acronym CAFOs, the animals are so isolated from the natural environment, but yet still there is that cross-section between wildlife and these animal farms.
Yeah, and so many different, we do courses on epidemiology, right? Like thinking about the epidemiology of a disease or the ability to transmit. And there's so many nuances when we think about how a virus can get from one animal to the next or from one area to the next. And I think it's really interesting when we sit here in St. Louis and think how separate the urban environment is from the wild, let's say. But we know a few miles away is Forest Park, and it's one of the places where flyover occurs, where birds come through, where we're so much more connected than we realize, I think, whether we live in an urban space, a rural space, or out in, quote, pristine wild lands. And I think it's really, when we think about how interconnected we are across the globe, we can really see how these pathogens can move through populations.
We're talking about industrial factory farming of animals bred for meat. And I was looking up about zoonotic diseases, and I'm curious what antibiotic resistance, how that plays into this as well, because about 80% of antibiotic use in the U.S. is used, fed to animals raised for meat production in these factory farms. Does antibiotic resistance, is that a part of this increase in zoonotic disease, or how does it play into that?
Yeah, so thinking about antibiotic resistance in humans as well as other animal species, and I'll get to that, I think is one of those other huge One Health challenges, right? So we know the human population, which is 8 billion and counting, part of the reason we've been so successful is our ability to have antibiotics, right? So antibiotics are our arsenal against bacterial infections. And when antibiotics are overused or misused, or as you've pointed out, used in our food-producing animals, it allows bacteria to very cleverly be able to be resistant to those drugs we might use to protect ourselves against a bacteria that we have. And so I think it plays into some of these health challenges in a non-infectious way for infection. So I think it has, in a good news part of this, we are realizing the significance of overuse of antibiotics for things such as food animals and what that creates in the long run to lessen our ability to fight off bacterial infections in humans and other animals. And I just want to point out, we at the St. Louis Zoo and with our colleagues, we've done a number of studies of wildlife species in the Galapagos Islands that have been exposed and have antibiotic-resistant genes in their feces. So this is a global issue that's impacting animals and humans across the globe.
Even animals that live in a relatively isolated area like the Galapagos Islands.
Yes. Hmm. Yeah.
So much of promoting positive change, good health, One Health, is having conversations like these, awareness. But then when you talk about solutions, what do we do next? What's the next step after awareness? It seems a really daunting task to try to change. I mean, these are big systems where we've decided to farm. You know, there's well-established, you know, systems there. There's a lot of money. I mean, the value of poultry and poultry products in the U.S. in 2023 was more than $67 billion. So this is a huge industry. What kind of systemic change would be possible, knowing that there's already so much that's established and that may not want to change what it's doing while it's making a lot of money?
Yeah, I love this question. And it's something I think a lot about because, you know, I'm a wildlife veterinarian and a conservationist. So wildlife conservation is, you know, sort of what drives me in my position at the St. Louis Zoo. And I always find it interesting when I bring up food and food security and what did you eat today and sort of thinking about how what we eat, what we put on our dinner tables has this ripple global effect for conservation. And so these systems that we as a society, as a species have reached for to feed the 8.2 billion humans on the planet have created some of these real health challenges. And so I think, you know, the awareness that you just pointed out is huge. Like, I hope everyone thinks today, what did I eat and where did it come from? There's some statement that here in the U.S., you may eat food from 24 different countries today and what that wow. might mean. For the footprint of your food intake and so how were those animals treated and how you know we can get into animal welfare but thinking sort of how what I eat, what my family eats may be playing into some of these questions of pandemics. And I think really it's up to all of us to sort of be aware of that, to think about it and think how their actions may be able to put I don't want to use the word pressure, but put some things in place that helps us maybe reimagine our food systems today.
Mm. That gets in kind of, you know, our ability as individuals to promote change beyond the bigger systemic change that needs to happen. You're kind of talking about like purchase power, that almost like voting with your wallet
yep.
in a way.
And voting with your what you put on your dinner table tonight. Yep.
Are there other things that we can do to limit the spread of zoonotic disease, these diseases that spread between animals and humans? And it sometimes goes the other way, right? Humans to animals. I mean, are there just simple steps? Like, could we be better at washing our hands, avoiding insect bites? I mean, of course, no one likes to get bit by an insect. We're always trying to avoid those.
Yeah, so all those what we may call simple measures, simple hygiene, like the reason we have 8+ billion people on this planet is because of good public health and because of what we have learned over the last centuries in terms of washing your hands, like you just said, or making sure you cook your food products in the appropriate way. So I think all those simple little things do add up and do protect your family, yourself. When we think of tick-borne diseases or mosquito-borne diseases, West Nile virus, Zika, you know, some of those big ones that most all of us have heard about, we can protect ourselves from those vectors, the mosquitoes or the ticks, from those vectors that might carry those diseases. So all these things that you learned in kindergarten probably do add up to protecting yourself from many of these zoonotic pathogens.
We're listening to producer Emily Woodbury's conversation with wildlife veterinarian and epidemiologist Dr. Sharon Deem. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back shortly to continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Elaine Cha. Let's dive back into our conversation about bird flu and the interconnectedness of human health and that of other animal species. Here's producer Emily Woodbury speaking with wildlife veterinarian and epidemiologist Dr. Sharon Deem of the St. Louis Zoo.
As an epidemiologist, you spend a lot of time on the big picture questions, you know, how pathogens spread between and across species. You're also a veterinarian who works one-on-one with animals, and you're a noted animal lover. So when we're talking about avian influenza and seeing not just birds, but so many species be affected by this virus right now, what's it like for you personally to witness what's happening?
Yeah, thanks, Emily. So I've been in this business for a number of decades now, and I've dedicated my career in veterinary medicine to the conservation of endangered species. So I think the question is a personally very difficult because when you are a witness to die-offs, like some of these die-offs with tens of thousands of marine mammals, or many of your listeners may have heard of the 1,500 sandhill cranes that died from avian influenza recently. When we see these kind of losses in these amazing animal species and populations, it can be really, really challenging to keep that positive. Let's keep moving forward and working on conservation. So when we have a pathogen like avian influenza, where we are starting to wake up to preventive measures for humans, we need to not forget sort of the preventive measures we should be putting in place to help minimize the impact of this virus on other species and some of these incredible wildlife populations.
And this bird flu is happening amidst, a simultaneously occurring, or maybe this is just part of it, mass extinction event. Not to get too bleak, but this is the reality of the world that we live in now. We're in the midst of a six mass extinction, and this is just contributing to it.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought it up, and we'll get a little bit low, but we're going to end on hope because we always have hope.
Yes.
And there's so much that each of us can do and are doing. But you are correct. We are now experiencing what we call the sixth mass extinction. And for the first time in the history of the planet, this extinction rate or loss of non-human species on the planet is 1,000 times the rate above sort of that normal baseline. And for the first time in history, we humans are the ones driving the extinction of these species. And I think we should all think about that for a minute or two and kind of
maybe a few more minutes, too. Maybe more than a minute or two.
Or maybe for you next generation One Health practitioners, maybe for your full career, we should be thinking about this. And really, what are the measures that we can take to slow extinction or slow the loss of these wildlife populations? And I think for those other listeners who might not be conservationists, if you look into it, you will see that your health, your family's health is dependent on the conservation of biodiversity, on the conservation of other animal species. And so that should get all of us to care about how we can minimize and slow down this sixth mass extinction or rate of extinctions that are occurring.
What's a good example of that interconnectedness that we can really take with us and say, oh yeah, this is a great example of how positively impacting our environment and other animals helps us as humans?
Yeah, I hope I understand the question, and I hope you're okay that I'm going to move away from avian influenza and another topic that many of us do think about, and that's plastic pollution. So plastic pollution has been in the news now for decades, right? And ways we can minimize plastic use and single-use plastics. And many of us have heard of the Pacific garbage patch and just the where the plastic we use, where it ends up. And we know that this plastic, both the plastic itself, can create challenges to animal health. We've seen the whale on the beach with a stomach full of plastic. We've seen the sea turtle with a straw in its nose. And we know that plastics themselves can cause problems. But we've also learned, and some of the studies we've done through the St. Louis Zoo, that the chemicals in plastics have real physiological impacts on human and animal species. So these endocrine disruptors. So here's what I think is a health challenge for humans and animals alike that really can be solved, right? Because minimizing the use of plastics, figuring out how to handle the plastic pollutants of today would only improve your health and my health, but also would help with the conservation of wildlife and biodiversity. So that's a real win-win when we tackle one of these non-infectious disease problems that are, that is really facing species across the globe.
Yeah. And it's not just whales that they found plastic in. I mean, plastic is in all of us right now.
Plastic's in all of us. That is correct.
So what does give you hope? So much of what we're talking about is so daunting and so hard, and it's so global. And you're thinking, okay, what can I as an individual do? What is giving you hope right now?
So many things. There are so many things that are giving me hope. Just being invited here to speak with you and the interest in this topic with your listeners. But a couple things come to mind. And we talked about the interview 5 years ago at the, you know, on the doorsteps of the COVID-19 pandemic. A couple years before that, I actually here in St. Louis gave a TEDx talk. And in it, I talk about sort of You need a heart attack. You as a human, you need a heart attack before you're going to listen to your doctor, before you're going to slow down on drinking or smoking or eat better. And we today, you know, thinking about the changes, the health impacts on this planetary scale, I would argue we're sort of at that planetary heart attack point. And that might not sound hopeful, but just like that patient, the single human patient, we as a community are seeing this, and it takes a heart attack, it takes a crisis for people to move into action, and that gives me hope. And I think a lot of the younger generation, younger folks maybe listening to this right now, they see the connections, they see the health challenges and connections with humans, animals, plants, the environments that keep us all healthy, and they want to take action. And so I find that very hopeful.
You're the director of the St. Louis Zoo Institute for Conservation Medicine, which I believe is about in its 14th year now. Are there examples of, in your work with the Institute, are there examples of gains when it comes to habitat conservation, species recovering from the brink of extinction, that we might apply to all the challenges that we're talking about today?
Yeah, so another program that the zoo's been very instrumental in for the last almost 14 years is down in Galapagos Islands off the coast of Ecuador. And I just returned from our field site there where we were with the iconic giant Galapagos tortoises.
And how giant? Just to give us a picture.
How giant? Let's say 600, 700 pounds for the big males. So
wow.
So they're big. Google a photo and you'll say, wow, that is a giant tortoise. But you know, the work we do through the Galapagos Tortoise Movement Ecology Program is really looking at the challenges they face, the what they need to thrive, this iconic giant tortoise. But if we look back at the history of conservation for Galapagos tortoises in the last 50 years, where many of those species were on the brink of extinction in the 70s, and the global community, many different partners, including the St. Louis Zoo, have worked to restore these species and these populations and repopulate them out to the islands where they once lived. And 50 years later, that's a real comeback story for this incredible gentle giant of this archipelago of the Galapagos Islands. And that's, I feel very good about the part that our zoo has played in that, but also just the community of conservationists over the decades that have made that possible.
And when you say the work the zoo's done on that, specifically, is this something we can apply to other endangered species of taking species into zoos, sanctuaries, breeding programs, and then eventually with the goal of bringing them back.
Love that question. So one of the great things of accredited zoos, which the St. Louis Zoo is an AZA accredited zoo, so much of what we do is both here on campus at our zoo, but also globally, right? So out in the quote wild. And we have a number of programs, both at our zoos and many other zoos, where we do what's called captive breeding, where we breed animals in human care, and then we replace them to the wild. And one of the really great example of work that the St. Louis Zoo has done with partners here in Missouri is the hellbender. So that crazy little amphibian that's in our streams.
Little snot otter.
The little snot otter. And really sort of using the skills, the education of our staff at the St. Louis Zoo to work with these animals, and then to be able to reintroduce them back into their natural waterways here in the state. So you may see a snot otter when you're out rafting this summer. I mean, that's beautiful. And that's one of the really, one of the many, but one of the roles that zoos have played in the last decades with bringing species back from the brink.
Dr. Deem, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Emily. I really enjoyed it.
This episode was produced and recorded by Emily Woodbury.
Podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.